Hello, good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Patricia Juncosa. I'm a curatorial assistant at the Department of Architecture and Design here at the Museum of Modern Art. And I work together with curator Paolo Antonelli and Andrea Lips in the exhibition Design and the Elastic Mind that is now on view on the sixth floor. But Design and the Elastic Mind is a survey of the latest advancements in design. Is about designers' ability to grasp the momentous changes in science, in design, into social mores, and turn them into objects and into systems that people can understand and use. So with each new technological era comes with its own malady, this sense of disruptment that comes with progress and with new technologies. That's why innovation is often called disruptive. In the past few decades, even more with the computer, with the internet, with wireless technologies, we have experienced big changes in our relationship with time and with space, with scale, and even the very notion of the individual is shifting. You just have to look at your everyday life, how every day we are moving and working between different time zones. We are inundated with big amounts of information. We can move very easily with Google Maps and satellite maps. So we are living very fast in order to be able to slow down. So we need to adapt. And adaptation is one of the traces of human nature. But today, with this acceleration of life, we need something else, and we need elasticity. And that's the elasticity we're dealing with in this exhibition. We like to think of our minds and our bodies having these elastic muscles that help us bounce back and forth between the jumps and scale and time every day. And elasticity is the ability to grasp progress and make it your own. And the designers and the objects in this exhibition are helping us to become more elastic and take an advantage that this ability we have to adapt. So revolutions are not easy on us, especially when they come as fast and as they're happening in the last few decades. And just think of innovations like the airplane, the computer, or the TV that at first were not very well accepted, and now we cannot imagine our lives without them. And even little changes, like when we have to switch computers or cell phones, are already a disruption. So the designers are the ones that help us make this transition. They don't make the revolutions happen, but are the ones that help us cope with them and make them part of our everyday life. So what you are seeing here is the first thing you will see as you enter the exhibition, is the title wall of the show, and is the work of Hector. Hector is a very particular robot. It is an output device that consists of a spray can, that it's driven by a computer. It translates the information from the computer into the ink on the wall. But it's much more than graffiti. It's a reflection on the tools and the new tools today. For instance, the information on the computer only becomes real with an output device that could be a screen of a printer. So Hector is that. It's an output device that translates the very abstract information and the software inside the computer into something that is closer to us and to the human hand. So still, what are you seeing here is the title of the show. The designer, Jörg Lenny, worked together with Irma Boom, who is the graphic designer of the catalog, to adapt the typeface and the identity of the exhibition to something that Hector could draw. But what they did, instead of like when you draw, you leave your hand and go from one letter to the next, they let Hector on the wall at all times. In this way, he's not only drawing the letters, but also the vector graphic paths that the computer, the way the computer is thinking. So you are able to see the invisible thought of the computer and the software. And it's a way to revealing the logic behind the design. And if you get even closer, you see this is Hector. This is a can that is hanging from these wires. And you see the tension between the precision and the high tech of the computer, in contrast with the ink, with this imperfection of the edges, this roughness, and even the dripping of the paint. So it's this tension between high-tech and low-tech that we see in the show. And also we like to think of Hector as a symbol of what the show is about, is designed as a bridge between the abstraction of research and the abstraction of technology and the contradictions of the real world. So the whole exhibition in the space is divided using the idea of scale. In the physical space of the sixth floor upstairs, we go to the very small, to the nanoscale and macroscopical scale, to the scale of nature, all the way to the very big, to the very big amounts of information, to the internet, the city, and even the cosmos. So through this lecture, we will also follow this path from the very small to the very large. And these icons that you see here are the icons that accompany every object. So you go to the show, every label has this little graphic sign, where we see the relation in this case with the very small, with the nano, with the matter. And but you see that in all of them, there's always the human presence there. Because designers bring always everything back to the individual. So the one-to-one scale, the individual, and the individual with the computer is the point of reference for all the objects in the show. So we start with the very small, with nanotechnology, and it's here when we see designers and scientists really coming together. And this is how the whole exhibition started, with dialogues between scientists and designers. We organized for the past year and a half a series of monthly salons together with Seed Magazine, and where we will put them together and have those dialogues. And what we notice there is how scientists are trying to abandon pure science and trying to bring their theories and the research into the real world. They're trying to bring their work from the lab into the street. While designers, on the other side, they don't want to be seen as something more than decorators and beautifiers, and they want to be seen as thinkers, also interpreters of this reality. So it's all about elevating design and humanizing science. Now, at the very small scale, both designers and scientists are looking at the way nature works, the ability of nature to build things atom by atom and molecule by molecule, but following a bottom-up process in which it's not the hand of the designer or the hand of the scientist that puts together the parts, but you just give some information to these individual parts and let them self-assemble and self-organize the same way that atoms and molecules work in nature across all scales, all the way to the cosmos. What you see here is a DNA origami. It's the work of a scientist called Paul Thaufman that took advantage of the ability of DNA to store information. So each one of the particles of DNA fold on itself. He used both natural DNA and synthetic DNA and embedded information on them and forced them to fold using the strands of DNA to create those smileys. But he has also drawn like big maps of the world or even letters. And these could potentially be used, for instance, to create computer chips or nanomachines. And what's interesting here for us is how scientists are starting to make things, are starting to work as designers. And this is what has been called like nanofacture. Similar to this, we have the work of designers at also the nanoscale. This is called Rules of Six. It's one of the four commissions that we have in the exhibition. It's the work of Ben Aranda and Chris Lash, two architects based in New York. They are also trying to replace the usual top-down way of building and designing, but with the bottom-up system that they are also observing in nature. So they created those panels, the big image that you see, of these structures growing, and they extracting the rules that they found in nature. They created an algorithm, which is the red image on top, and is the mathematical rules that guide all those processes. They define an algorithm like almost a recipe for making bread. So there in the galleries, we have this algorithm running live, and it's the algorithm that created the shapes. And at the same time, this algorithm, they extracted from nanostructures grown in the lab, which is the image that you see at the bottom. They work together with the material scientists to try and do that, to extract and to find the rules of nature, to apply them to anything. So it's more than a design object of its, by itself. Going back to the panel, it's not the panel is not a design and an end on itself, but it's more of an exploration of a way of building and designing across scales. With this system, they are trying to do anything from a design object to even the planning of a city. An interesting pairing of design and science that we have in the exhibition is on the left. You have the little particles. They are these microscopic particles in the shapes of all the letters of the alphabet. They are used as markers. Usually they use fluorescent dyes or proteins to mark as markers. But in this case, he was able to synthesize letters using polymeric materials dispersed in a liquid solution. And that, again, could be used to build any kind of microscopic machines with medical applications. And on the right is typosperma, is instead a concept by a designer that he tries to work on what he called biotypography, in which he envisions these transgenic creatures that are half human sperm and half typography. So again, this is all only a common experimentation, but is what was interesting for us as well is that the scientist, when he visited the show, was very, very happy to have been paired with this type of sperma with this work. So it's this dialogue between science and design that that gives shape to the whole exhibition. And the exhibition presents many concepts and many prototypes and projects that more than actual finished products that you can find in the stores. But even there, there's always a connection with actual research. It's not science fiction. It's all based in actual research that is taking place and in a few years could be out in the street. So on the left is the work of Symbiotica, a group of scientists and artists in Australia, that they have been able to grow to grow meat in the laboratory by using cells. So this is what they call disembodied cuisine. So they don't need to kill the animal anymore, but just extract those cells and grow them in vitro in the lab. So one of the designer on the right, James King, he took these ideas, and he thought, well, now when we don't need to kill the animal anymore, there's a whole range of questions. Besides, of course, there is no waste of energy by feeding the animal and also no pollutants. There's all another different range of questions, ethical and social, that interested him. So what is the shape, the texture, and the taste of this new meat? How is going to be served? And even more than, is it okay for vegetarians to eat it? So what he did is he went across the British countryside and selecting the more, for him, the more interesting, the better specimens of livestock, he would scan them head to toe, and they'd pick the most beautiful sections, which might not necessarily match the parts of the cow that we eat today. But still, he wants to keep a familiar shape, so we still remember where this artificial meat came from. And another designer taking the work of the tissue culture into a design object. This is called biojewelry and is already a medical technique that would allow in the future to grow bone tissue to repair for reconstructive surgery. In this case, what he did is he took different couples who donated their bone cells. He created a scaffold, ceramic scaffold, so the bone cells would grow around it. And so and he would create those rings, so each partner is wearing a piece of your partner with you. It's a way of linking two people together. So the last two projects that you saw is the work of two designers from the Royal College of Art. So the dialogue between science and design is mutating design. Designers now have to think more abstractly. It is this new approach to design that is called design for debate, in which designers are thinking of the more social ethical implications of new technologies as they go from the lab into the everyday world. It's like designers can fast forward, take a peek into the future, and imagine these new scenarios. It's not so much about designing objects only, but also the scenarios that come with it. And they use all kinds of narrative tools, like videos, animations, or books. This is the work of Anthony Dunn and Fiona Rabi. They are both professors at the Royal College, and particularly Tony Dunn is the head of the Design Interactions Department, where all this design for debate idea came from. And we have in the exhibition a few projects by students from this program. This here is called Technological Dream Series Robots. So the thought of the design of designing new robots, but design the robots, they don't look the way that you would think a robot would look like. And that's the whole point. People would ask him, but this doesn't look like a robot. So they would say, okay, what's a robot and how does it look like? So they are more interested in this is where they want to be. Their work is about posing questions rather than just giving straight answers. So they pose questions like, how are these robots, are we going to take care of them instead of they taking care of us as would be? So will they have assigned functions, or instead we will see how what the personalities are and then assign them the tasks? So each one of these four robots have a very particular personality. For instance, this first one has the ability to pick up the electromagnetic fields in the room, and he lifts and moves to the safest part of the room. It's like a graphic sign marking the safest place in the room so you can sit inside and be safe from those electromagnetic fields. Oh, this one is very needy, and it can scan your iris in order to switch on. You have to stare into its eyes for a long time. He has to recognize you and be sure that it's you. So each one of these robots raises questions about the human relationship with the human-machine relationship, and it's more trying to find a more emotional relationship with the high technology products in the house. And their aim at the end is that the questions themselves start to be read as answers. An example of some of these new strategies and narrative tools that the designers at the Royal College are using, this is called New Sensual Interfaces, and the project itself is this video that is running in the galleries. Here you see a few frames. And the designer is working trying to break the misconceptions about nanotechnology, particularly the idea of nanotechnology is all about having better materials, stronger materials. It is not only that, but it's also creating new materials and new objects altogether. Again, taking that ability, this bottom-up ability of matter, having information and building different objects, self-organizing itself, he envisioned new objects for the future. The whole interaction with the human with the objects is going to change. An object is not going to be a fixed thing. It could change function. It can mutate one thing into the other just by reorganizing this smart dust that he recreated by using linseeds. So it raises questions on how we're going to use these new products and what a product and what an object actually is. Also, their designers thinking of the social implications of new technologies. This project is called Nanotopia by Michael Barton, another student from the Royal College, and how this ability of manipulating matter at the nanoscale is shaping an utopian vision of the future, where the difference the gap between rich and poor, it will be even wider. Same way than today, people trade with their organs or with the blood, thinking in the future, when taken to the stream, the poor people will use their body as real estate, the way that they will use their bodies for medical purposes, and so the rich could take advantage of that for new cosmetic rituals, for instance, growing these long eyelashes. Or also using genetic manipulation in order to enhance your senses, senses that we don't use fully today. You could be able to grow these whiskers so you could pick up the signals in your environment, or for instance have those cilia in your nails so you could scrap the DNA from the other person when shaking their hands. In this way, you can collect genetic materials and know more about the other person, and she envisioned it. This being used, for instance, for mating. New ways of connecting the individual memory to the body. using again the idea, the technology of the in vitro culture meat, these designers thought, for instance, you could even grow a mole of your partner in your shoulder. Or going to the extreme of technology gone very wrong, when you lose the boundaries between what's real and when it's artificial, you could have this pet or this toy that could be customized. You could change the hair and the skin, and even go further by tattooing or piercing it. So it's a project called Cautionary Visions that looks into the dark side of the future. Going to again to scenarios from actual technologies, Elio Cacavale, in his project Utility Pets, he tackles the idea of xenotransplantation, the possibility of transplant between species, and particularly the possibility of having the carrying the heart of a pig, and how today genetic manipulation is enabled by studying the possibility of making the pig heart compatible with the human heart. So that again poses a new series of questions. What if you have a pig that is potentially carrying your organs? Who is going to take care of that? You possibly want to have it in your home and give the pig a better life. So what kind of objects are going to rise around this new scenario? He, for instance, he thought of the smoke eater that prevents the pig from secondhand smoke, which could damage the organ that is carrying, or this low-resolution TV, so when the pig gets bored, he just has to walk by, and the TV would switch on, and you give him a better quality of life. And then what happens when is the moment when you need the organ and you have to sacrifice the animal, and you have already this relationship or this attachment to the animal? So there is a memento service that will put the pig's note in this clear case as a remembrance. Or also you could use the pig's note to create this comforting device that every morning will remind you that you are not a pig, and it will help you get into terms with the fact that you are carrying a foreign body inside you. So go to the one-to-one scale, how new technologies are completely changing the way, not only the notion of the individual, but also how we relate to each other. With new technologies, and particularly with portable devices and miniaturization of technology, is completely there's a new set of rules on how we have to behave. There's new etiquette, new norms that have to be written. There's the space, the individual space now. Your individual space doesn't just stop when the next one starts, but they are those intersections. So we need all a new set of good manners. And there are also other issues that designers are exploring, like breakup of a relationship or the loss of a loved one. Regarding new etiquette, this is the Dauphin headphone. The designer went to a mobile clubbing event, one of those parties where everybody's wearing it's listening to its own music with a portable device. Your friend as well are listening to their own music. So she noticed how when someone wanted to greet another person, they would just remove their earphone and they put it back. And instead, when they really wanted to initiate a conversation, they would remove both earphones. And that would remind her of the act of hat doffing, and how people would just remove their hat and put it back when they wanted to greet someone in the street, or instead remove it completely and put it under their arm when they really wanted to stop for a conversation. So this is a new device for a new technology that instead is looking at traditional ways and social manners. What about the breakup of a relationship? How do we cope with that in the technological era? This is the work of designer Noam Toran, again, faculty of the Royal College, that not only creates the objects, but also the narratives and the context that go with them. He's also a filmmaker, and he illustrates also these ideas with films. This is accessories from Lonely Man. It's 8 electronic objects that help us cope with the loss of a breakup of a relationship. It's all about the little things that you used to hate about your partner, but that now you miss now that you don't have the person anymore. For instance, you have on the left this sheet thief that would pull the sheets from your bed while you are sleeping, or another choice of sharing a bed is the cold feet, or the heavy breather that will breathe hot air on your neck, or the hair alarm clock that will wake you up in the morning with the hair on your face. Or the chest hair curler, the shared cigarette, the plate thrower, or the silhouette that protects the silhouette of the woman on the wall. And again, as we move through all these different technologies, we need to recuperate our roots and our emotional and psychological vinculation to the objects. In particular, these next two projects are dealing with death. This is called digital remains, and things like today, we are much more than our physical selves because we have all our computer files or our digital selves that are stored in this remote network. So what happens to all that when we die? So she created these objects that besides being an object of remembrance, it has a little engraved epitaph, also is has a Bluetooth device. So when you place it close to your computer, it will pull out the desktop of the deceased person on your computer. And also has an algorithm that will search and will pull out, for instance, pictures of a trip you took together with that person, or your favorite song or moments that you shared. Another project that copes with that is Afterlife. So when with religion, you always could find some comfort on the idea of a heaven or an afterlife. So what happens with new technologies? Where do you find that comfort? So these designers, they took a technology that could potentially, that has been experimented with animals, that you can actually extract the gastric juices of a corpse and translate it into energy and store it in a battery using a microbial fuel cell. So you can store the energy of the deceased person into these batteries, also very beautiful engraved, and you could power everything from a flashlight or Christmas decoration or even a vibrator that is said as the final act of love. So this way the dead person lives on as pure energy, and this is where you find some solace with your loss. So that takes us to the idea of existence maximum, when the whole concept of privacy has changed today. Privacy is not about seclusion, but about being more selective about the way you relate to other people and you relate to the world. For instance, when we see here in New York, when we go on the subway, that people are wearing their iPods or they have their Blackberries, and they create those bubbles of space that isolate them from the other people. So you create this big metaphysical space that's much bigger than the actual physical space that you occupy. You expand the one-to-one scale with these micro devices is expanding much better. But it's in a way filtering. It's not a total a compact bubble, but it's filtering the information, so there's still some exchange. And on the opposite side, when you get to your home in the solitude of your home, you get into the internet and you connect to the whole world. We create those screen names and those virtual alter egos, and even those people that navigate through virtual worlds, that's like Second Life, or they create virtual relationships that sometimes for them are stronger and more meaningful than the ones in the real world. So here are three projects by James Auger and Jimmy Loiseau that they deal with that. In this era of new technologies and with these virtual alter egos, what is the face that you present to the world, and how do you cope with the real world when you are used to having this computer screen protecting you? This is an interstitial space helmet that is about that, about people that have problems with dealing with real people in the real world. This is a screen, you can create your screen-based face that help you deal with real people. And this is social telepresence that is a real technology that can be defined as the experience of being fully present at a remote and real location that is away from the one that you actually occupy. is being used by the military and also for exploratory purposes for people to be able to survive in very extreme conditions and in very inhospitable environments. For instance, the designers now instead have translated this into a social context, and which I think can also be a very inhospitable place to be. And for instance, imagine you are a very shy person and you have a blind date, so you could wear this social telepresence helmet and you will send another person in your place. The host will be wearing this helmet with a camera. All his senses will be blocked. He will only receive instructions from the user. And the user will be wearing goggles and receiving all the input and experiences everything that the host body is experiencing. Or this isophone, also real technology, that makes them think about today with technologies, with the ubiquitous presence of cell phones, we can have a phone conversation everywhere and anytime without thinking if it's appropriate anymore. They want to restore the quality of communications. In this isophone, you have your head outside the water with this helmet that cancels any input from the exterior. And also your body is floating in water at body temperature, so also it frees your mind from the engagement to, from calculating gravity. So it's a pure focus into the conversation. So we see with all these projects and with the idea of existence maximum, we transcend the one-to-one scale of the human body by means of miniaturization and portability technology. So again, we're bouncing back and forth with very, very small devices and instead open a whole world. So we go to the relation between the individual and the objects with 3D printing. With these technologies that you can translate the drawing and the computer file directly from the computer using a 3D printing rapid manufacturing machine into the object. There are different techniques, but basically you use either liquid or powder resin with a laser beam, and layer by layer you can create those objects. It's an actual technology that now maybe takes 7 days to print a chair, but in the future will only take maybe 7 hours or 7 minutes. So you could just buy the computer file online and then in your own home print directly the object and even be able to modify the file and customize it within certain parameters. So there's not a unique object anymore. And there's the distinction between the prototype and the mass produced object doesn't exist anymore. Besides the efficiency and the fact that, again, there's less waste of materials, there's no distribution, no storage. So this is a section in the show when we have more real products. These are all products that you can actually buy. This is the one-shot foldable stool. It's the work of designer Patrick Rouen for the firm Materialize. And Materialize was one of the first companies to use 3D printing, not for industrial parts, but for domestic objects. And in particular here, using laser sintering techniques, they can build this very complicated stool with all its joints and articulations all in one shot with one process. And that's the name. And this is also, for Materialize, is a bowl that, again, has this tension between the high-tech and the low-tech. There's this very intricate pattern that made with an algorithm in the computer that instead recreates the idea of hand-carved ivory filigree. The designers from Freedom of Creation have taken a step further into printing textiles using 3D printing. So again, there's no weaving, cutting, or sewing, but only being printing the textile layer by layer in one process, though the bag that you see is made in one shot also with no cutting and no stitches. Designers from Design, they use motion capture video technology so they can translate directly the sketches and these drawings in the air into the object. So from the drawing directly into the object. Or this lamp is called attracted to light that tries to freeze the movement of a moth around a light bulb. So it's also making visible an unseen form, trying to freeze time and space. And this light, instead, it plays with this idea that with that now there is not a unique object, but thousands of different objects. The same way that different species, that or the humans, that we are all different, but we all have something that tells us that we belong to the same group. So they started with a round sphere, and depending on how they would distribute the matter, they would have these three ramifications, and on, until you have a whole range of objects and not two are alike. And this is a Corifab chair that instead uses stop-motion animation. You have this animation of different shapes of the chair running, and you could stop and pick any frame and send it to the computer, and that will be the chair. And again, you get a whole range of different chairs depending on the frame that you're picking. So with each stream, you call for the opposite extreme. And this is a vase made by bees. It is what the designer calls slow prototyping. He built a hive, a scaffold in the shape of a hive, and following the archetypical form of a vase, so the bees, during 1 week, 40,000 bees would build this this vase. So it's the designer is calling to the idea of slowness. We have to slow down because now today everything is going very fast. So again, to the bigger scale, with also our relation with other individuals, that today not only the notion of the individual and privacy, but also the connection between the individual and the community is changing. The same idea of self-organization, this bottom-up process that we saw in nature and in nanotechnology, is also applying to the community and to the social sphere. Like, it's the idea that an ocean of minds is much better than a single person. So the idea of collaboration within these dialogues between designers and between disciplines, and especially the open source gestures, are what interests us. These are the bubble blocks, is the works of two New York-based designers that looked around and think, what's the characteristic of New York? Is not so much the museums, it's not the landmarks, but the people. The fact that there are so many different religions and cultures living together, all different, but all made of the same blocks. So they created these little wooden figures inspired by the people that they saw at the Lower East Side, where they live. And each one of these characters has its own MySpace page, and they even film little videos in different situations. So the project or is not only the design, is not only the object now, but it's also a whole range of things. So they also asking the question what a product really is today. Or different comments and strategies on the impact of the individual in the community. This is the SMS Guerrilla Projector by the collective called Troika. This is a portable device, battery operated, that you can carry around and project your text messages in a public environment as massive projections. And then a similar taken on the subject is the work of Graffiti Research Lab, that they are providing technological tools for graffiti artists and also activists so they can have an impact in the urban environment in the same scale that advertisers of corporations. This is the laser tag by using special software, computer projector and a whole trick with the camera, they and using a laser pointer, they can create this illusion of drawing in a building and again having a big impact on a big scale in the city. And actually had them here at the opening of the exhibition. They brought about 40 graffiti artists from 5 boroughs, and they turned the atrium of the museum into a big canvas. And what's most interesting for us in this project, it's not, again, so much the graffiti, but the idea of open source. The software that they develop is open source, which means they put it out there together with a set of do-it-yourself instructions for the equipment, so anybody could use it. And now they are Graffiti Research Lab, laser tagging groups all over the world. And another project that probably know is the One Laptop Per Child project, formerly known as the $100 laptop, developed the MIT Media Lab to give children in the developing world access to a computer. And besides the good design of the computer itself as an object, for us it was very important also the interface. It's called Sugar. It's an icon-driven interface developed only for this computer by Pentagram, a group of designers. What's interesting here also is you see the antennas on top of the computer. The computer really, and the interface, when it really works, is when all the computers are connected to each other, not besides being connected to the internet. So it's again this idea that a full range of minds is better than only one, and the interface gets even better and more complicated as all the computers are linked, and it's all based in activities and in exchanges between the different laptops. So we get finally to the very big scale, to the scale of information. Again, we need someone to filter all these big amounts of information we're inundated with today and give it back to us. And designers are the ones who are helping us to manage the complexity. To visualize the data is to understand it. So it's the ability to understand all the phenomena around it, from the very small, again, to the very big. But when we talk about big or small, here we refer not to, it's not a physical scale, but also the scope that all the impact all this information. This is, for instance, mapping the internet is an attempt to visualize the internet, something as metaphysical that's invisible, something that is not meant to be seen, trying to translate it into a visual form. Or something very small, like the genome, this protein homology graph that tried to visualize the connections between similar genes in different organisms. Or even something as trivial as the Pac-Man Atari game that visualizes not only all the mathematical operations, but also the commands, like the code to, are represented by those lines that connect the symbols. And this is the work of Ben Fry. Ben Fry, together with Casey Rias at the MIT Media Lab, he developed Processing. Processing is an open source programming language based on Java language that is so simple that it could be picked up by almost anyone, a non-programmer, but at the same time, is so sophisticated that you can create the most incredible examples of visualization and animation. And actually, there are a few works in the exhibition that are using Processing. And again, it's open source. They just put it out there. And people not only use it, but also improved it. And right now, I think there are like 60 different libraries and variations of Processing. Using some examples of other designers using Processing, this is called Cinema Redux and is the whole movie Vertigo just seen at a glance in front of your eyes. By using Processing, the designer picked one frame every second of the movie. And if you go to the galleries, it's a big wallpaper, floor to ceiling, and each one of the lines in this wallpaper is 1 minute of the film. So you see the whole film in front of your eyes, and you can sort of understand the pace and the rhythm of the film, the colors, and even the editing. Some animations using Processing. This is a thinking machine. And here you play a chess game against the computer, and you are able to see the way the computer thinks. Before every move, the computer will think of all the different possibilities of its moves and your own moves. So something, again, that is not meant to be visible is put in front of your eyes. You're seeing the way the computer thinks, and the very act of thinking is made visible. Another animation running in the gallery is using Processing that is also about tagging and mapping is flight patterns. The designer is tracking all the flights coming in and out of the United States. And with that, you see only with that how the map is forming. Like he monitor all the flights during 24 hours. You see at the beginning how the East Coast is very bright. And then as the West Coast is waking up, the whole map in the United States is forming. So we go into visualization and mapping and tagging, and from the airplanes now tracking the yellow cabs in the San Francisco area using GPS technology. Again, they are able to shape, in this case, the whole city, and you see the pulse and of the city, and you see all kind of phenomena that usually are not visible. This is what we call the invisible dynamics. And going also mapping, and now we go to the individual back again. This is the work of Torolab. Torolab is a collective also of artists, of designers that work in the transborder region between Mexico and the United States. This project is called the Region of the Transborder Trousers. So they picked five people who live and work in this transborder region, and they gave them the transborder trousers with GPS so they could track their movements, and they could track their fuel consumption, their velocity, their migratory status. So they would create a map with no geographical borders, but it's more a map of interactions and economical exchanges. And this is a New York Stock Exchange, is the work of the Sensible City Lab at MIT. And they are tracking live all the telephone communications and also internet data coming in and out of New York at any given time. And with that, they can make a very, they can reconstruct and they can get a 100% real approximation of the shape, of the population of the city. In this case, there are two visualizations in the gallery, one showing this sphere with the brighter points where the communications are stronger, or this whole map of the world where you see countries stretching or expanding as communications get stronger in those places. And with that, they could get a very live picture of the city of New York, of this diversity of the city of New York, and they even found amazing things. That, for instance, in Queens, they found out that the two main groups are Philippines and Guyana, even more than India or Puerto Rico, that wouldn't think. So this is even more, you can trust that even more than a regular census. And I want to end also with the work of Ben Fry, again, using processing. This is an image that illustrated an article on Seed Magazine when there was this discovery of that humans and chimps are like 95.77% alike. So what Ben did, he took one of the genes that are more different, is the gene linked to language, and he saw that even there, from the 75,000 letters that this gene has, there's only 9 differences between the human and the chimp. So this, with one image, you get the whole idea, and it's much stronger than just giving you a long explanation. And again, Ben Fry, this is genomic cartography. This is one of the first also projects that you see as you enter the gallery. It's a big wallpaper next to the entrance of the show, and we go again back to the genome. He's trying to also put in front of your eyes, in this case, the 70 million letters of chromosome 18, and showing you with different colors the different functions, the pieces of code. The darker ones are the ones that are used to build proteins. The softer, the gray ones are the ones that still we don't know what they're doing. So again, trying to manage this huge amount of information, try to grasp it in a way that can be more understandable for us. So we have been moving back and forth also between scales. We have gone from the very small to the very big and back again to the scale of the genome. But we see that always the individual is at the center. So the designers always bring everything back to the human scale. And is the whole design and this show is about understanding the macro changes and adapting them to the micro concerns of our everyday lives. Thank you.